There wasn't even a sales clerk hanging out, a welcome adult to put a stop to things before they got entirely out of hand. He could hear the three dinosaurs of the apocalypse closing in now, and he simply couldn't run anymore. Each breath produced a deep hurting stitch in his left side. His eye fixed on a door which read, "Emergency exit only. Alarm will sound." Hope kindled in his chest. Richie ran down an aisle crammed with Donald Duck jack-in-the-boxes, United States Army tanks made in Japan, Lone Ranger cap pistols, wind-up robots. He reached the door and slammed the push bar as hard as he could. The door opened, letting in cool mid-March air. The alarm went off with a strident bray. Richie immediately doubled back and dropped to his hands and knees in the next aisle over. He was down before the door could settle closed again. Henry Belch and Victor thundered into the toy department just as the door clicked shut and the alarm cut off. They raced for it, Henry in the lead, his face set and intent. A sales clerk finally appeared, coming on the run. He wore a blue nylon duster over a plaid sport coat of excruciating ugliness. The rims of his spectacles were as pink as the eyes of a white rabbit. Richie thought he looked like Wally Cox in his Mr. Peepers role, and he had to slam his traitor mouth into the fat part of his forearm to keep from screaming out gales of exhausted laughter. "You boys," Mr. Peepers exclaimed, "you boys can't go out there. That's an emergency exit. You, hey, you boys." Victor glanced at him a little nervously, but Henry and Belch never turned from their course, and Victor followed them. The alarm brayed again, longer this time, as they charged into the alley. Before it stopped clanging, Richie was on his feet and trotting back toward ladies' lingerie. "You boys will be barred from the store," the clerk yelled after him. Looking back over his shoulder, Richie squealed in his granny grunt voice, "Did anyone ever tell you you look just like Mr. Peeper's young man?" And so he had escaped. And so he had finished up almost a mile from Freese's in front of City Center. And, he devoutly hoped, out of harm's way, at least for the time being. He was spent. He sat down on a bench just to the left of the Paul Bunyan statue, wanting only a little peace while he got himself back together. In a bit, he would get up and head home, but for now it felt too good to just sit here in the afternoon sun. The day had opened in a cold, drizzly gloom, but now you could believe spring might actually be on the way. Farther up the lawn, he could see the City Center marquee, which on that March day bore this message in large blue translucent letters. "Hey teens, coming March 28th, the Ernie Woo Woo Ginsburg Rock and Roll Show. Jerry Lee Lewis, the Penguins, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps, Freddie Boom Boom Cannon. An evening of wholesome entertainment." That was a show Richie really wanted to see, but he knew there wasn't a chance. His mother's idea of wholesome entertainment did not include Jerry Lee Lewis telling the young people of America, "We got chicken in the barn, whose barn, what barn, my barn." Nor, for that matter, did it include Freddie Cannon, whose Tallahassee lassie had a hi-fi chassis. She was willing to admit that she had done her share of screaming for Frank Sinatra, whom she now called Frankie the Snot, as a Bobby Soxer, but, like Bill Denbrough's mother, she was deaf on rock and roll. Chuck Berry terrified her, and she declared that Richard Penniman, better known to his teen and sub-teen constituency as Little Richard, made her want to barf like a chicken. This was a phrase for which Richie had never asked a translation. His dad was neutral on the subject of rock and roll and could perhaps have been swayed, but Richie knew in his heart that his mother's wishes would rule on this subject. Until he was 16 or 17, anyway, and by then, his mother was firmly convinced the country's rock and roll mania would have passed. Richie thought Danny and the Juniors were more right on that subject than his mom. Rock and roll would never die. He himself loved it, although his sources were really only two: American Bandstand on Channel 7 in the afternoon, and WMEX out of Boston at night, when the air had thinned and the hoarse, enthusiastic voice of Arnie Ginsberg came wavering in and out like the voice of a ghost called up at a seance. The beat did more than make him happy. It made him feel bigger, stronger, more there. When Frankie Ford sang Sea Cruise, or Eddie Cochran sang Summertime Blues, Richie was actually transported with joy. There was power in that music, a power which seemed to most rightfully belong to all the skinny kids, fat kids, ugly kids, shy kids, the world's losers, in short. In it, he felt a mad, hilarious voltage which had the power to both kill and exalt. He idolized Fats Domino, who made even Ben Hanscom look slim and trim, and Buddy Holly, who, like Richie, wore glasses, and Screaming Jay Hawkins, who popped out of a coffin at his concerts, or so Richie had been told, and the Dovells, who danced as good as black guys. Well, almost. He would have his rock and roll someday if he wanted it. He was confident it would still be there for him when his mother finally gave in and let him have it. But that would not be on March 28, 1958, or in 1959, or... His eyes had drifted away from the marquee, and then, well, then he must have fallen asleep. It was the only explanation that made sense. What had happened next could only happen in dreams. And now he was here again, a Richie Tozier who had finally gotten all the rock and roll he had ever wanted, and who had found, happily, that it still wasn't enough. His eyes went to the marquee in front of City Center and saw that, with a hideous kind of serendipity, those same blue letters spelled out, June 14th, Heavy Metal Mania. Judas Priest, Iron Maiden. Buy your tickets here or at any Ticketron outlet. Somewhere along the way, they dropped the wholesome entertainment line. But as far as I can tell, that's just about the only difference, Richie thought. And heard Danny and the Juniors, dim and distant, like voices heard down a long corridor coming out of a cheap radio. Rock and roll will never die. I'll dig it to the end. It'll go down in history. Just you watch, my friend. Richie looked back at Paul Bunyan, patron saint of Derry. Derry, which had come into being, according to the stories, because this was where the logs fetched up when they came downriver. There had been a time when, in the spring, both the Penobscot and the Kanduskeag would have been solid logs from one side to the other, their black bark hides glistening in the spring sun. A fellow who was fast on his feet could walk from Wally's Spa in Hell's Half Acre over to Rampers in Brewster. Rampers was a tavern of such horrible repute that it was commonly called the Bucket of Blood, without getting his boots wet over the third crossing of his rawhide laces. Or so it had been storied in Richie's youth, and he supposed there was a bit of Paul Bunyan in all such stories. Old Paul, he thought, looking up at the plastic statue. What you been doing since I've been gone? Made any new riverbeds coming home tired and dragging your axe behind you? Made any new lakes on account of wanting a bathtub big enough so you could sit in water up to your neck? Scared any more little kids the way you scared me that day? Ah, and suddenly he remembered it all. The way you will sometimes suddenly remember a word which has been dancing on the tip of your tongue. There he had been, sitting in that mellow March sunshine, drowsing a little, thinking about going home and catching the last half hour of bandstand, and suddenly there had been a warm swash of air into his face. It blew his hair back from his forehead. He looked up, and Paul Bunyan's huge plastic face had been right in front of his, bigger than a face on a movie screen, filling everything. The rush of air had been caused by Paul's bending down, although he did not precisely look like Paul anymore. The forehead was now low and beetling. Tufts of wiry hair poked from a nose as red as the nose of a longtime drunkard. His eyes were bloodshot, and one had a slight cast to it. The axe was no longer on his shoulder. Paul was leaning on its haft, and the blunt end of its head had crushed a trench in the concrete of the sidewalk. He was still grinning, but there was nothing cheery about it now. From between gigantic yellow teeth, there drifted a smell like small animals rotting in hot underbrush. I'm going to eat you up, the giant had said in a low, rumbling voice. It was the sound of boulders rocking against each other during an earthquake. Unless you give me back my hen and my harp and my bags of gold, I'm going to eat you right the fuck up. The breath of these words made Richie's shirt flutter and flap like a sail in a hurricane. He shrank back against the bench, eyes bugging, hair standing out to all sides like quills, wrapped in a pocket of carrion stink. The giant began to laugh. It settled its hands on the haft of its axe, the way Ted Williams might have laid hold of his favorite baseball bat, or ash handle, if you prefer, and pulled it out of the hole it had made in the sidewalk. The axe began to rise into the air. It made a low, lethal, rushing sound. Richie suddenly understood that the giant meant to split him right down the middle. But he felt that he could not move. A logy sort of apathy had stolen over him. What did it matter? He was dozing, having a dream. Any moment now, some driver would blow his horn at a kid running across the street, and he would wake up. That's right, the giant had rumbled. You'll wake up in hell. And at the last instant, as the axe slowed to its apogee and balanced there, Richie understood that this wasn't a dream at all. And if it was, it was a dream that could kill. Trying to scream, but making no sound at all, he rolled off the bench and onto the raked gravel plot which surrounded what had been a statue and was now only a base with two huge steel bolts sticking out of where the feet had been. The sound of the descending axe filled the world with its pressing, insistent whisper. The giant's grin had become a murderer's grimace. Its lips had pulled back so far from its teeth that its plastic red gums, hideously red, gleamed. The blade of the axe struck the bench where Richie had been only an instant before. The edge was so sharp that there was almost no sound at all, but the bench was sheared instantly in two. The halves sagged away from each other, the wood inside the green painted skin a bright and somehow sickening white. Richie was on his back. Still trying to scream, he pushed himself with his heels. Gravel went down the collar of his shirt, down the back of his pants. And there was Paul, towering above him, looking down at him with eyes the size of manhole covers. There was Paul, looking down at one small boy cowering on the gravel. The giant took a step toward him. Richie felt the ground shudder when the black boot came down. Gravel spumed up in a cloud. Richie rolled over onto his stomach and staggered to his feet. His legs were already trying to run before he was balanced, and as a result, he fell flat on his belly again. He heard the wind woof out of his lungs. His hair fell in his eyes. He could see the traffic going back and forth on Canal and Main Streets as it did every day, as if nothing was happening, as if no one in those cars could see or care that Paul Bunyan had come to life and stepped down from its pedestal in order to commit murder with an axe roughly the size of a deluxe motorhome. The sunshine was blotted out. Richie lay in a patch of shade that looked like a man. He scrambled to his knees, almost fell over sideways, managed to get to his feet, and ran as fast as he could. He ran with his knees popping almost all the way up to his chest and his elbows pistoning. Behind him, he could hear that awful, persistent whisper building again, a sound that seemed to be not really sound at all, but pressure on the skin and eardrums. Swip! The earth shook. Richie's upper and lower teeth rattled against each other like china plates in an earthquake. He did not have to look to know that Paul's axe had buried itself half deep in the sidewalk inches behind his feet. Madly in his mind, he heard the Dovells. Oh, the kids in Bristol are sharp as a pistol when they do the Bristol stomp. He passed out of the giant shadow into sunlight again, and as he did, he began to laugh, the same exhausted laughter that had come from him when he bolted downstairs in Freese's. Panting, that hot stitch in his side again, he had at last risked a glance back over his shoulder. There was the statue of Paul Bunyan, standing on its pedestal where it always stood, axe on its shoulder, head cocked toward the sky, lips parted in the eternal optimistic grin of the myth hero. The bench which had been sheared in two was whole and intact, thank you very much. The gravel where tall Paul, he's a my all, Annette Funicello sang maniacally in Richie's head, had planted his huge foot, was raked and immaculate, except for the scuffed spot where Richie had fallen off while he was getting away from the giant, dreaming. There was no footprint, no axe slash in the concrete. There was nothing here but a boy who had been chased by other boys, bigger boys, and so had had himself a very small, but very potent, dream about a homicidal colossus, the giant economy-size Henry Bowers, if you pleased. Shit, Richie said in a tiny wavering voice, and then uttered an uncertain laugh. He stood there a while longer, waiting to see if the statue would move again, perhaps wink, perhaps shift its axe from one shoulder to the other, perhaps come down and have at him again. But of course none of those things happened. Of course. What, me worry? Hardy har har har. A doze, a dream, no more than that. But as Abraham Lincoln or Socrates or someone like that had once observed, enough was enough. It was time to go home and cool out, to make like Kooky on 77 Sunset Strip and just lay chilly. And although it would have been quicker to cut through the city center grounds, he decided not to. He didn't want to get close to that statue again. So he had gone the long way around, and by that evening he had nearly forgotten the incident. Until now. Here sits a man, he thought. Here sits a man dressed in a mossy green sport coat purchased at one of the best shops on Rodeo Drive. Here sits a man with Bass Weegans on his feet and Calvin Klein underwear to cover his ass. Here sits a man with soft contact lenses resting easily on his eyes. Here sits a man remembering the dream of a boy who thought an Ivy League shirt with a Fruit Loop on the back and a pair of snapjack shoes was the height of fashion. here sits a grown-up looking at the same old statue. And hey, Paul, tall Paul, I'm here to say you're the same in every way. You ain't aged a motherfucking day. The old explanation still rang true in his mind. A dream. He supposed he could believe in monsters if he had to. Monsters were no big deal. Hadn't he sat in radio studios at one time or another reading news copy about such fellows as Idi Amin Dada and Jim Jones, and that guy who had blown away all those folks in a McDonald's just down the road a piece? Shit fire and save matches. Monsters were cheap. Who needed a $5 movie ticket when you could read about them in the paper for 35 cents or hear about them on the radio for free? And he supposed if he could believe in the Jim Jones variety, he could believe in Mike Hanlon's version, at least for a while. It even had its own sorry charm, because it came from outside, and no one had to claim responsibility for it. He could believe in a monster that had as many faces as there are rubber masks in a novelty shop. If you're going to have one, you might as well have a pack of them, he thought. Cheaper by the dozen, right, gang? At least for the sake of argument. But a 30-foot-high plastic statue that stepped off its pedestal and then tried to carve you up with its plastic axe? That was just a little too ripe. As Abraham Lincoln or Socrates or someone had also said, I'll eat fish and I'll eat meat, but there is some shit I will not eat. It just wasn't. That sharp needling pain struck his eyes again without warning, jerking a dismayed cry from him. This was the worst yet, going deeper and lasting longer, scaring the bejesus out of him. He clapped his hands to his eyes and then groped instinctively for the bottom lids with his forefingers, meaning to pop his contacts out. It's maybe some kind of infection, he thought dimly, but Jesus, it hurts. He pulled the lids down and was ready to give the single practiced blink that would send them tumbling out, and he would spend the next 15 minutes groveling myopically for them in the gravel surrounding the bench, but Jesus God, who gave a shit? Right now it felt like there were nails in his eyes. When the pain disappeared, it did not dwindle. It just went. One moment there, the next moment gone. His eyes teared briefly and then stopped. He lowered his hands slowly, his heart running fast in his chest, ready to blink them out the instant the pain started again. It didn't. And suddenly he found himself thinking about the only horror movie that had ever really scared him as a kid, possibly because he had taken so much shit about his glasses and had spent so much time thinking about his eyes. The movie had been The Crawling Eye with Forrest Tucker. Not very good. The other kids had laughed themselves into hysterics over it. But Richie had not laughed. Richie had been rendered cold and white and dumb, for once with not a single voice to command, as that gelatinous tentacle eye came out of the manufactured fog of some English movie set, waving its fibrous tentacles in front of it. The sight of that eye had been very bad, the embodiment of 100 not-quite-realized fears and disquiets. On some night not long after, he had dreamed of looking at himself in a mirror and bringing a large pin up and sticking it slowly into the black iris of his eye and feeling a numb, watery springiness as the bottom of his eye filled up with blood. He remembered, now he remembered, waking up and discovering that he had wet the bed. The best indicator of how gruesome that dream had been was that his primary feeling had been not shame at his nocturnal indiscretion, but relief. He had embraced the warm, wet patch with his body and blessed the reality of his sight. Fuck this, Richie Tozier said in a low voice that was not quite steady, and started to get up. He would go back to the Derry townhouse and take a nap. If this was memory lane, he preferred the L.A. freeway at rush hour. The pain in his eyes was probably no more than a signal of exhaustion and jet lag, plus the stress of meeting the past all at once in one afternoon. Enough shocks, enough exploring. He didn't like the way his mind was skittering from one subject to the next. What was that Peter Gabriel tune? Shock the Monkey. Well, this monkey had been shocked enough. It was time to catch some Z's and maybe gain a little perspective. As he rose, his eyes went to the marquee in front of City Center again. All at once, the strength ran out of his legs, and he sat down again. Hard. Richie Tozier, man of 1,000 voices, returns to Derry, land of 1,000 dances. In honor of Trash Mouth's return, City Center proudly presents the Richie Tozier All Dead Rock Show. Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, The Big Bopper, Frankie Lyman, Gene Vincent, Marvin Gaye. House Band, Jimi Hendrix, lead guitar. John Lennon, rhythm guitar. Phil Lynott, bass guitar. K. Keith Moon, drums. Special guest vocalist, Jim Morrison. Welcome home, Richie. You're dead, too. He felt as if someone had whopped all the breath out of him. And then he heard that sound again, that sound that was half pressure on the skin and eardrums, that keen, homicidal, whispering rush. Swip. He rolled off the bench onto the gravel, thinking, so this is what they mean by deja vu. Now you know. You'll never have to ask anybody again. He hit on his shoulder and rolled, looking up at the Paul Bunyan statue. Only it was no longer Paul Bunyan. The clown stood there instead, resplendent and evident, fantastic in plastic. 20 feet of day-glow colors, its painted face surmounting a cosmic comic ruff. Orange pom-pom buttons cast in plastic, each as big as a volleyball, ran down the front of the silvery suit. Instead of an axe, it held a huge bunch of plastic balloons. Engraved on each were two legends. It's Still Rock and Roll to Me, and Richie Tozier's All Dead Rock Show. He scrambled backward, using his heels and his palms. Gravel went down the back of his pants. He heard a seam tear loose in the underarm of his Rodeo Drive sport coat. He rolled over, gained his feet, staggered, looked back. The clown looked down at him. Its eyes rolled wetly in their sockets. Did I give you a scare, my man? It rumbled. And Richie heard his mouth say, quite independently of his frozen brain, cheap thrills in the back of my car, bozo, that's all. The clown grinned and nodded, as if it had expected no more. Red, paint-bleeding lips parted to show teeth like fangs, each one coming to a razor point. I could have you now if I wanted you now, it said, but this is going to be too much fun. Fun for me, too, Richie heard his mouth say. The most fun of all when we come to take your fucking head off, baby. The clown's grin spread wider and wider. It raised one hand, clad in a white glove, and Richie felt the wind of the movement blow the hair off his forehead as it had on that day 27 years ago. The clown's index finger popped out at him. It was as big as a beam. Big as a bee, Richie thought, and then the pain struck again. It drove rusty spikes into the soft jelly of his eyes. He screamed and clutched at his face. Before removing the mote from thy neighbor's eye, attend the beam in thine own, the clown intoned, its words rumbling and vibrating, and Richie was again enveloped in the sweet stink of its carrion breath. He looked up and took half a dozen hurried steps backward. The clown was bending down, its gloved hands on its gaily pantaloon knees. Want to play some more, Richie? How about if I point at your pecker and give you prostate cancer? Or I could point at your head and give you a good old brain tumor, although I'm sure some people would say that would only be adding to what was already there. I can point at your mouth and your stupid flapping tongue will turn into so much running pus. I can do it, Richie. Want to see? Its eyes were widening, widening, and in those black pupils, each as big as a softball, Richie saw the mad darkness that must exist over the rim of the universe. He saw a shitty happiness that he felt would drive him insane. In that moment, he understood it could do any of these things and more. And yet again, he heard his mouth, but this time it was not his voice or any of his created voices, past or present. It was a voice he had never heard before. Later, he would tell the others, hesitantly, that it was a kind of Mr. Jive-Ass Nigger voice, loud and proud, self-parodying and screechy. Get off my case, you big old honky clown, he shouted, and suddenly he was laughing again. No shit and no shine, muffa. I got to walk, I got to talk, and I got the big boppin' cock. I got the time, I got the mind. I'm a man with a plan, and if you don't shit, you gon' get. You hear me, you white-faced bunghole? Richie thought the clown recoiled, but he did not stick around to find out for sure. He ran, elbows pumping, sport coat flying out in wings behind him, not caring that a father who had stopped so his toddler could admire Paul was now staring warily at him, as if he had gone crazy. As a matter of fact, folks, Richie thought, I feel like I've gone crazy. Oh, God, do I ever. And that had to have been the shittiest Grandmaster Flash imitation in history, but somehow it did the trick, somehow. And then the clown's voice thundered after him. The father of the little boy did not hear it, but the toddler's face suddenly pinched in upon itself and began to wail. The dad picked his son up and hugged him, bewildered. Even through his own terror, Richie observed this little sideshow closely. The voice of the clown was perhaps angrily gleeful, perhaps just angry. We've got the eye down here, Richie. You hear me? The one that crawls. If you don't want to fly, don't want to say goodbye, you come on down under this here town and give a great big hi to one great big eye. You come down and see it any time, just any old time you like. You hear me, Richie? Bring your yo-yo. Have Beverly wear a big full skirt with four or five petticoats underneath. Have her wear her husband's ring around her neck. Get Eddie to wear his saddle shoes. We'll play some bop, Richie. We'll play all the hits. Reaching the sidewalk, Richie dared to look back over his shoulder. And what he saw was in no way comforting. Paul Bunyan was still gone. And now the clown was gone, too. Where they had stood, there was now a 20-foot-high plastic statue of Buddy Holly. He was wearing a button on one of the narrow lapels of his plaid sport coat. Richie Tozier's All Dead Rock Show, the button read. One bow of Buddy's glasses had been mended with adhesive tape. The little boy was still crying hysterically. His father was walking rapidly back toward downtown with the weeping child in his arms. He gave Richie a wide berth. Richie got walking. Feats don't fail me now. Trying not to think about, we'll play all the hits. What had just happened? All he wanted to think about was the monster jolt of scotch he was going to have in the Derry Townhouse bar before he went up to take that nap. The thought of the drink, just your ordinary garden variety drink, made him feel a little better. He looked over his shoulder one more time, and the fact that Paul Bunyan was back, grinning at the sky, plastic axe over his shoulder, made him feel better still. Richie began to walk faster, making tracks, putting distance between himself and that statue. He had even begun to think about the possibility of hallucinations when the pain struck his eyes again, deep and agonizing, causing him to cry out hoarsely. A pretty young girl who had been walking ahead of him, looking dreamily up at the breaking clouds, looked back at him, hesitated, then hurried over. "Mister, are you all right?" "It's my contacts," he said in a strained voice. "My damned contact lens. Oh, my God, that hurts." This time he got his forefingers up so quickly he almost jabbed them into his eyes. He pulled down the lower lids and thought, "I won't be able to blink them out. That's what's going to happen. I won't be able to blink them out. And it's just going to go on hurting and hurting and hurting until I go blind, go blind, go blind." But one blink did it, as one blink always had. The sharp and defined world, where colors stayed inside the lines and where faces that you saw were clear and obvious, simply fell away. Wide bands of pastel fuzz took their place. And although he and the high school girl, who was both helpful and concerned, searched the paving of the sidewalk for almost 15 minutes, neither could find even a single lens. In the back of his head, Richie seemed to hear the clown laughing. 5. Bill Denbro sees a ghost. Bill did not see Pennywise that afternoon, but he did see a ghost, a real ghost. So Bill believed then, and no subsequent event caused him to change his mind. He had walked up Witcham Street and paused for some time by the drain where George met his end on that rainy October day in 1957. He squatted down and peered into the drain, which was cut into the stonework of the curbing. His heart was beating hard, but he looked anyway. "Come out, why don't you?" he said in a low voice, and he had the not-quite-mad idea that his voice was floating along dark and dripping passageways, not dying out, but continuing onward and onward, feeding on its own echoes, bouncing off moss-covered stone walls and long-dead machinery. He felt it float over still and sullen waters and perhaps issue softly from 100 different drains in other parts of the city at the same time. "Come out of there, or we'll come in and get you." He waited nervily for a response, crouched down with his hands between his thighs like a catcher between pitches. There was no response. He was about to stand up when a shadow fell over him. Bill looked up sharply, eagerly, ready for anything. But it was only a little kid, maybe 10, maybe 11. He was wearing faded Boy Scout shorts, which displayed his scabby knees to good advantage. He had a freeze pop in one hand and a fiberglass skateboard, which looked almost as battered as his knees, in the other. The freeze pop was a fluorescent orange. The skateboard was a fluorescent green. "You always talk into the sewers, mister?" the boy asked. "Only in Derry," Bill said. They looked at each other solemnly for a moment and then burst into laughter at the same time. "I want to ask you a stupid question, Bill said. "Okay," the kid said. "You ever hear anything down in one of these?" The kid looked at Bill as though he had flipped out. "Okay," Bill said. "Forget I asked." He started to walk away and had gotten maybe 12 steps. He was headed up the hill, vaguely thinking he would take a look at the home place, when the kid called, "Mister?" Bill turned back. He had his sport coat hooked on his finger and slung over his shoulder. His collar was unbuttoned, his tie loosened. The boy was watching him carefully, as if already regretting his decision to speak further. Then he shrugged, as if saying, "Oh, what the hell?"
"Yeah."
"Yeah?"
"Yeah."
"What did it say?"
"I don't know. It talked some foreign language. I heard it coming out of one of those pumping stations down in the Barrens. One of those pumping stations. They look like pipes coming out of the ground."
"I know what you mean. Was it a kid you heard?"
"At first it was a kid, then it sounded like a man."
The boy paused.
"I was some scared. I ran home and told my father. He said maybe it was an echo or something coming all the way down the pipes from someone's house."
"Do you believe that?" The boy smiled charmingly.
"I read in my Ripley's Believe It or Not book that there was this guy. He got music from his teeth. Radio music. His fillings were like little radios. I guess if I believed that, I could believe anything."
I Bill said. "But did you believe it?" The boy reluctantly shook his head. "Did you ever hear those voices again?"
"Once when I was taking a bath," the boy said. "It was a girl's voice. Just crying, no words. I was scared to pull the plug when I was done because I thought I might, you know, drown her."
Bill nodded again. The kid was looking at Bill openly now, his eyes shining and fascinated.
"You know about those voices, mister?"
"I heard them," Bill said, "a long, long time ago. Do you know any of the kids that have been murdered here, son?" The shine went out of the kid's eyes. It was replaced by caution and disquiet.
"My dad says I'm not supposed to talk to strangers. He says anybody could be that killer."
He took an additional step away from Bill, moving into the dappled shade of an elm tree that Bill had once driven his bike into 27 years ago. He had taken a spill and bent his handlebars.
"Not me, kid," he said. "I've been in England for the last 4 months. I just got into Derry yesterday."
"I still don't have to talk to you," the kid replied.
"That's right," Bill agreed. "It's a free country."
He paused and then said, "I used to pal around with Johnny Fury some of the time. He was a good kid. I cried,"
the boy finished matter-of-factly, and slurped down the rest of his freeze pop. As an afterthought, he ran out his tongue, which was temporarily bright orange, and lapped off his arm.
"Keep away from the sewers and drains," Bill said quietly. "Keep away from empty places and deserted places. Stay out of train yards, but most of all, stay away from the sewers and the drains."
The shine was back in the kid's eyes, and he said nothing for a very long time. Then,
"Mister, you want to hear something funny?"
"Sure."
"You know that movie where the shark ate all the people up?"
"Everyone does. Jaws.
Well, I got this friend, you know? His name's Tommy Vicinanza, and he's not that bright. Toys in the attic, you get what I mean?"
"Yeah."
"He thinks he saw that shark in the canal. He was up there by himself in Basie Park a couple of weeks ago, and he said he seen this fin. He says it was 8 or 9 feet tall. Just the fin was that tall, you get me? He goes, that's what killed Johnny and the other kids. It was Jaws. I know because I saw it. So I go, that canal's so polluted, nothing could live in it, not even a minnow. And you think you saw Jaws in there? You got toys in the attic, Tommy. Tommy says it reared right out of the water like it did at the end of that movie and tried to bite him. And he just got back in time. Pretty funny, huh, mister?"
"Pretty funny," Bill agreed.
"Toys in the attic, right?"
Bill hesitated.
"Stay away from the canal, too, son. You follow?"
"You mean you believe it?"
Bill hesitated. He meant to shrug. Instead, he nodded. The kid let out his breath in a low, hissing rush. He hung his head as if ashamed.
"Yeah, sometimes I think I must have toys in the attic."
"I know what you mean."
Bill walked over to the kid, who glanced up at him solemnly, but didn't shy away this time.
"You're killing your knees on that board, son."
The kid glanced down at his scabby knees and grinned.
"Yeah, I guess so. I bail out sometimes."
"Can I try it?"
Bill asked suddenly. The kid looked at him, gape-mouthed at first, then laughing.
"That'd be funny," he said. "I never saw a grown-up on a skateboard."
"I'll give you a quarter," Bill said.
"My dad said,
never take money or candy from strangers. Good advice. I'll still give you a quarter. What do you say? Just to the corner of Jackson Street."
"Never mind the quarter," the kid said. He burst into laughter again. A gay and uncomplicated sound. A fresh sound. "I don't need your quarter. I got $2. I'm practically rich. I got to see this, though. Just don't blame me if you break something.
Don't worry, Bill said. I'm insured.
He turned one of the skateboard's scuffed wheels with his finger, liking the speedy ease with which it turned. It sounded like there was about a million ball bearings in there. It was a good sound. It called up something very old in Bill's chest. Some desire as warm as want, as lovely as love. He smiled.
What do you think? The kid asked.
I think I'm gonna kill myself, Bill said, and the kid laughed.
Bill put the skateboard on the sidewalk and put one foot on it. He rolled it back and forth experimentally. The kid watched. In his mind, Bill saw himself rolling down Witcham Street toward Jackson on the kid's avocado green skateboard, the tails of his sport coat ballooning out behind him, his bald head gleaming in the sun, his knees bent in that fragile way snow bunnies bend their knees their first day on the slopes. It was a posture that told you that in their heads they were already falling down. He bet the kid didn't ride the board like that. He bet the kid rode to beat the devil, like there was no tomorrow. That good feeling died out of his chest. He saw all too clearly the board going out from under his feet, shooting unencumbered down the street, an improbable fluorescent green, a color that only a child could love. He saw himself coming down on his ass, maybe on his back. Slow dissolve to a private room at the Dairy Home Hospital, like the one they had visited Eddie in after his arm had been broken. Bill Dendro in a full body cast, one leg held up by pulleys and wires. A doctor comes in, looks at his chart, looks at him and then says, "You were guilty of two major lapses, Mr. Denbro. The first was mismanagement of a skateboard. The second was forgetting that you are now approaching 40 years of age." He bent, picked the skateboard back up, and handed it back to the kid.
"I guess not," he said.
"Chicken,"
the kid said, not unkindly. Bill hooked his thumbs into his armpits and flapped his elbows. "Buck, buck, buck," he said. The kid laughed.
"Listen, I got to get home."
"Be careful on that," Bill said.
"You can't be careful on a skateboard," the kid replied, looking at Bill as if he might be the one with toys in the attic.
"Right," Bill said. "Okay, as we say in the movie biz, I hear you. But stay away from drains and sewers, and stay with your friends."
The kid nodded. "I'm right near home."
"So is my brother," Bill thought. "It'll be over soon anyway," Bill told the kid.
"Will it?"
the kid asked.
"I think so," Bill said.
"Okay. See you later, chicken."
The kid put one foot on the board and pushed off with the other. Once he was rolling, he put the other foot on the board as well and went thundering down the street at what seemed to Bill a suicidal pace. But he rode as Bill had suspected he would, with lazy, hip-shot grace. Bill felt love for the boy, an exhilaration, and a desire to be the boy, along with an almost suffocating fear. The boy rode as if there were no such things as death or getting older. The boy seemed somehow eternal and ineluctable in his khaki Boy Scout shorts and scuffed sneakers, his ankles sockless and quite dirty, his hair flying back behind him.
"Watch out, kid. You're not going to make the corner,"
Bill thought, alarmed. But the kid shot his hips to the left like a breakdancer, his toes revolved on the green fiberglass board, and he zoomed effortlessly around the corner and onto Jackson Street, simply assuming no one would be there to get in his way.
"Kid," Bill thought, "it won't always be that way."
He walked up to his old house, but did not stop. He only slowed his walk down to an idler's pace. There were people on the lawn, a mother in a lawn chair, a sleeping baby in her arms, watching two kids, maybe 10 and 8, play badminton in grass that was still wet from the rain earlier. The younger of the two, a boy, managed to hit the bird back over the net, and the woman called,
"Good one, Sean."
The house was the same dark green color, and the fanlight was still over the door, but his mother's flower beds were gone. So, from what he could see, was the jungle gym his father had built from scavenged pipes in the backyard. He remembered the day Georgie had fallen off the top and chipped a tooth.
How he had screamed.
He saw these things, the ones there and the ones gone, and thought of walking over to the woman with the sleeping baby in her arms. He thought of saying, "Hello, my name is Bill Dendro. I used to live here." And the woman saying, "That's nice." What else could there be? Could he ask her if the face he had carved carefully in one of the attic beams, the face he and Georgie sometimes used to throw darts at, was still there? Could he ask her if her kids sometimes slept on the screened-in back porch when the summer nights were especially hot, talking together in low tones as they watched heat lightning dance on the horizon? He supposed he might be able to ask some of those things, but he felt he would stutter quite badly if he tried to be charming,
And did he really want to know the answers to any of those questions? After Georgie died, it had become a cold house, and whatever he had come back to Derry for was not here. So he went onto the corner and turned right, not looking back. Soon he was on Kansas Street, headed back downtown. He paused for a while at the fence which bordered the sidewalk, looking down into the barrens. The fence was the same rickety wood covered with fading whitewash, and the barrens looked the same, wilder, if anything. The only differences he could see were that the dirty smudge of smoke which had always marked the town dump was gone. The dump had been replaced with a modern waste treatment plant, and a long overpass marched across the tangled greenery now, the Turnpike Extension. Everything else was so similar that he might last have seen it the previous summer. Weeds and bushes sloping down to that flat marshy area on the left, and to dense copses of junky scrubby trees on the right. He could see the stands of what they had called bamboo, the silvery white stalks 12 and 14 feet high. He remembered that Richie had once tried to smoke some of it, claiming it was like the stuff jazz musicians smoked and could get you high. All Richie had gotten was sick. Bill could hear the trickle of water running in many small streams, could see the sun heliographing off the broader expanse of the Kanduskeag. And the smell was the same, even with the dump gone. The heavy perfume of growing things at the height of their spring strut did not quite mask the smell of waste and human offal. It was faint but unmistakable. The smell of corruption, a whiff of the underside. "That's where it ended before, and that's where it's going to end this time," Bill thought with a shiver. "In there, under the city." He stood a while longer, convinced that he must see something, some manifestation of the evil he had come back to Derry to fight. There was nothing. He heard water running, a spring-like and vital sound that reminded him of the dam they had built down there. He could see trees and bushes ruffling in the faint breeze. There was nothing else. No sign. He walked on, dusting a faint whitewash stain from his hands as he went. He kept heading downtown, half remembering, half dreaming. And here came another kid, this one a little girl of about 10 in high-waisted corduroy pants and a faded red blouse. She was bouncing a ball with one hand and holding a baby doll by its blonde Arnell hair in the other. "Hey," Bill said. She looked up. "What?" "What's the best store in Derry?" She thought about it. "For me or for anyone?" "For you," Bill said. "Secondhand Rose, secondhand clothes," she said with no hesitation whatsoever. "I beg your pardon?" Bill asked.
"You beg what?"
"I mean, is that a store name?"
"Sure,"
she said, looking at Bill as though he might well be enfeebled. "Secondhand Rose, secondhand clothes. My mom says it's a junk shop, but I like it. They have old things, like records you never heard of. Also postcards. It smells like an attic. I have to go home now. Bye."